Hey, Al. Jeffrey Wells speaking.
Hi, Jeff.
Hey. So I caught the humbling in Toronto.
Oh, good.
And thought it was. I love any and all takes on Philip Roth's soul and his mind and his sensibility. But I felt also that you guys spun it in your own direction. I mean, it was basically,
yeah.
I could feel you, I could feel Barry, I could feel like, you know, it wasn't a pure thing. It was kind of, you guys kind of making it anew in some sense. Is that?
Well, it is true. I'm glad to hear that from you because that was sort of what we were going to do is try to take that and adapt it in a way because sometimes that's almost necessary with book to movie. You know, you have to do something. And I think we felt somewhat confident because of our... It's about what we do, you know. The book is about us. So there was a belief that we could spin this thing in some way that accommodates the essence of the story, but also puts that other spin on it, and to approach it from a kind of to just bring out some of the humor to bounce that other stuff off of, you know, so that you can get both. And I think having Buck Henry writing and Barry Levinson together there, that would buoy it up a bit, and so that it could become more palatable. You know, it's a pretty depressing. It's a pretty depressing thing, and so you're trying to find something to at least give it that. And I think we all felt that overview, and we all sort of felt similar about that. It is kind of it makes you smile a little when you think of an actor trying to think of himself as never having been a person. Actor is not as non-person, you know. It's interesting and it's funny and it's a place we wanted to start from.
It's funny. The chatter, the talk in Toronto was comparing this to the David Gordon Green film that you were also appearing in during that festival.
And, yeah, I know. That was a coincidence. It was the strangest thing. You know, I rarely do these things, and then suddenly I'm out there with two.
So, you rarely do festivals, you mean?
Yeah, I don't do festivals hardly ever. And it compared to how long I've been around, it's like...
Well, is there something about the vibe of festivals you don't like? Or
no, absolutely not. I never had... When I did Looking for Richard, I did go to Cannes.
Yeah.
I remember that. I remember at the time... I got I met Janet Maslin, who was the critic of the Times at that time, and it was very helpful to the film. And there are films that that really benefit from that.
Mm.
And I've been told it, I've been to Sundance too.
Yeah, I remember the Sundance thing. I was there that year with it, Looking for Richard. I remember standing outside the Egyptian Theater in a pretty cold night, waiting. It was the big showing at the Egyptian, and a Fox Searchlight publicist telling me that she couldn't necessarily let me in, but we'd have to wait, and we waited, and we waited. And then finally, at like 20 minutes later, you came up with Redford and in an SUV, and it finally began. And I still couldn't get in, so...
That's the true story. That's the story I don't even get. They are the festivals, unless you're guided by somebody, can be kind of, you've got to go with the globe.
I love
doing
looking
two
for,
movies.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Al. I'm sorry.
But doing two movies in these festivals, two festivals, Venice, which is great, and the Toronto film, but two big film festivals.
Right. Have you ever been
to movies?
Have you ever been to Telluride for any reason?
I've been to Telluride, sure. I've been to that. That's tricky. That has a landing pad.
you've flown into that place.
I've flown into that.
Oh, wow.
Let me tell you, I don't recommend it, but it's a great festival.
I talked to an actual pilot told me he would never land there. He just wouldn't.
See that?
As a statement of
general. I mean, is there another way to get there?
Yeah, you go into, what's it called? It's about a 40-minute, 30-minute drive. I've forgotten the name of it. And there's also coming into Durango in Colorado. That's about an hour drive, so.
Well, that's what I'll do next time if I'm lucky enough to get there.
So you saw, that's funny. You saw the approach, and you went, whoa, here we go.
Yeah, I said, I'm not going to do this again.
You know, talk about vaguely impressing. I come from that neck of the woods where Barry lives. You guys use Barry's house, right?
Oh, you mean the Connecticut thing?
Yeah, I come from Westport Wilton. And that, to me, it represents a certain level of depression right there. But I tell you, I really like the humbling a lot. I settled into it and became very, I don't know, it just put me in a nice mood. There was something loose and amiable and engrossing and smart, you know. Not to put down the green film. I just like the humbling more, that's all.
Oh. Yeah. You know, the thing is that we did do that in these different locations. We did this movie because we knew we had a certain amount of time and or else it would just get away from us. We knew it. And we put all this time into it, and this was the time. But we did it in increments. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, you mean you drove up from New York and did it for a weekend or so, and then...
Yeah. Sometimes they went 4 or 5 days, went away. I mean, I did the Manglehorn film while I was doing Humbling.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So again, another thing I don't recommend.
Yeah. Where's the house? In Reading somewhere, or where is it?
In Connecticut?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
Somewhere in Fairfield County.
I live up there in Westchester in my house on the river. So it was about an hour every day going up there. So it's an hour from that.
Mm-hmm.
And
Are you thinking about any theater in the coming months?
Well, I'm going to be doing, actually, I'm doing David Mamet's new play. It's a new play. He just wrote it. And we're working on it. I'm going to bring it to New York next year.
Are you going to do it in Chicago first and then New York?
I would like to. Yeah. But that sort of has become a I don't know, it seems to be a thing of the past.
Mm-hmm.
I always saw it, but it takes so much time. I would like to find some place we do it before.
Yeah.
You know, to get it's because when you open in New York and you go, your previews aren't previews in New York. They're like, you know, everybody comes. Mm-hmm. So they're really used to shape up a play and get an audience. And you need that. You need the audience. So it's not done as much. When I did Merchant, I did it because we didn't have that. That issue because I did the movie and then I did the play in the park and they did it in rap, so it was plenty of rehearsals, so you had time to you know, to get acquainted with the play, to understand it in a certain way, especially vis-a-vis the audience, which is very important and a real process. So I really understand the value of out-of-town tryouts.
What's the Mamet play called? Can you give me a real quick rundown on what it is?
It's called China Doll.
Okay.
And it's an interesting play. It's got a certain... It has a certain dynamic that I think...
Right.
You know, we're still working on it and developing it. But he's written it. It's there.
Cool. I saw you twice in Buffalo, American Buffalo. Was that 80, 81 maybe? I know Circle in the Square was one, and I saw you, I guess it was Uptown. Didn't you guys take it up?
Circle in the Square, and then I did it Uptown on Broadway.
Yeah.
Started in New Haven.
Right.
And then I wound up doing it over 4 years.
I loved the way you did the opening thing, fucking Ruthie, fucking Ruthie, fucking Ruthie. You did that radically and really different in both times. I just thought it was great that you were fluid and improvisational enough to come up with a different way of doing it. I thought that was
that's one of the benefits, I believe, is why I do theater. One of the benefits is that you get to do a play over and over, and it goes in different directions, and it asks you to kind of go in and out of things, because you're bringing your life along with that play. Yeah. And there's nothing like long runs, especially when they're intermittent. You can go off and do a movie or something like that. So you come back to it, and it has a different, just have a different outlook on it.
Yeah.
Not that it changes that radically. You're still the same person. But it is a wonderful thing. It, with time, as I like, what I like mostly about time is somebody say, it repeats. Mm-hmm. Repeats keep me green.
Yeah.
I like that. I like that saying.
Have you ever, in your early days on theater, did you ever experience the horrifying sensation of going up? Like suddenly you left your body and you couldn't remember the next line and you were like,
Well, I have experienced it. But I had an experience when I was doing a play once where we were doing, which is why I'm not too high on 8 performances a week.
Mm-hmm.
I think the rigors of the stage are always there, whether you're young or older, doesn't matter, the rigors. And what happens is in those weekends where you've got 4 shows,
right,
or 5, you have 2, 1 on Friday, 2 Saturday, 2 Sunday.
Right.
What happens is strange things. And especially if you're doing the big roles, and which is what I was talking about with, in a sense, with Humbling. He was a character when out and did the big stage roles. I remember being in a play, a Shakespeare play. I'd done the matinee, and just like an hour later, maybe, I was doing it again. And it was these big, speeches, And there I am in the middle of the speech, and I'm just thinking as I'm doing it, I become overcome by the idea that I'm saying everything that I'm saying twice. Because I've just done it. So I'm thinking, I just said that, but didn't I? Well, should I say it again? Just keep going. then the audience is being very gracious to me. They're being very kind. Mm-hmm. They're allowing me to say everything. You get so, it's called being overtired.
Yeah.
Well, that's the, I've experienced that. I've experienced going from my Lord, I says, in a Shakespeare play, and going right into another play, as I said, my Lord, and I'm doing something out of Hamlet,
mm-hmm.
which I've never done, in another Shakespeare play. It does happen.
I saw Alec Guinness go up briefly in London once.
Oh, you did?
And I saw also your friends Kenneth McMillan and Duval when he was doing American Buffalo. I saw him, I thought it was fascinating. He just looked at McMillan, he was lost. And he just looked at him and threw his hands up and went, I'm out of it, man. And McMillan, like a real pro, just came right back and gave him a cue. Duval heard it and boom, he was off to the races. Everything was fine.
That is something, because in that same play, if you can imagine, having done it, I made an entrance once,
mm-hmm.
did my somewhat, started, and I had been playing it with J.J. Johnson for a while, and he knew me well, and we'd even get together. We would get together every night around 6 and mm-hmm. just talk about the play a little bit,
mm-hmm.
just as a preparation. And I did it again. I got out there, and I don't know what I was overcome. I just didn't know the words. No word came to me. And I took the longest time, and it was worth it, the look on his face. And usually when I go up or someone else goes up on stage, usually I can't help myself. I start laughing. Because it's just not supposed to be, You're supposed to land the plane, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, that was the time. I did it in Buffalo, too. I just stopped.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they just, what's the excuse? So many times.
Yeah. Hey, I heard a story, by the way, Al, about from Peter Rayner, the critic from, he's been around for...
I just saw him, yeah.
And he told me this hilarious story that you can tell me if it's secondhand, but you were waiting to take part in some kind of Q&A or some kind of...
appearance. Yeah, I was waiting. They were showing the humbling, and I was waiting to go on there for a Q&A.
Right.
And I was in this massive hotel downtown near the Staples Center in L.A.
Uh-huh.
I just walked in there by myself and a text, and I was reading, and I thought in this big place I'd be less conspicuous. So mm-hmm. I just sat there, and there was hardly anybody there, but it was a beautiful hotel lobby. And I was sitting there, and two young women were sitting on a platform above me to my left, and there they are having drinks, whatever, and I'm reading. And then, as if in a dream, I heard, "Sir? Sir?" And I looked up and I said, "What is this? These two young, attractive women are calling me?" I said, "Okay." I said, "What? Yeah? Can you, she said, "Do you think you could take a picture of us?" "Not with us, Mike. Of us." I said, "Well, I don't really know how to do it, but I'll give it a try, you wish." And so I got up, and she gave me the camera, and the two of them got together and pointed to where I should press it. And I did it rather easily and rather well, I might add. And I really captured them. I gave them back the phone, and they said, "Thank you." I said, "Well, thank you." For a moment there, I thought, gee, what a way to meet someone. And it turns out, though, they did backtrack, but 10 minutes later, somebody must have said something to them. "Who that guy is?"
That's funny that they came back and said, "Oh, my goodness."
But I love that stuff when that happens. You know, you realize it's... imagine being called sir and then actually being asked to take someone's picture.
I mean, yeah.
It just doesn't happen. I mean, it certainly doesn't happen to me.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah. Do you feel any physically different at all? Is there anything different about the present as opposed to, say, you know, boy, the way you felt physically, mentally, emotionally in the 70s? What's the evolution feel like, if any? I mean, or do you feel like it's exactly the same?
Well, I guess if I were in the 70s and just woke up today, that probably but it's a gradation, you know. And yeah. You sort of get used to the whatever it is that happens to us. You get used to it. I know I don't. Out of choice, I don't exercise as much.
Uh-huh.
But if you watch your diet, and you know, and of course I chase my young kids around, so that's always. But I feel I would imagine somewhat different. Yeah. The problem with me is sometimes I've had it, and I go back. It's sometimes the lower back, like Tony Romo.
Uh huh.
I have that I haven't been operated on, but if I'm careful with it, I think it becomes livable.
Did you like lift something improperly at one time? That's what happened.
At one time, yeah, I did a long time ago. But a long time ago, let me tell you something about age, because it's one of the perks.
Mm-hmm.
I had it on my upper back pain,
uh-huh.
Really devastating pain, and so much so I had to get wrapped up in it. But it was in my upper back. And then one day I went to the doctor, and I looked at, and he showed me the x-ray,
mm-hmm.
And he looked at me and he said, "You see, it's cured itself." I said, "Excuse me?" He said, "It's cured itself. It figured out a way to just stay there without ever bothering you again."
Wow.
Can you imagine that? Isn't that wonderful?
That's what I was told once myself. I had a terrible lower back thing because I incorrectly lifted a spruce tree. I was working for a landscaper, and I really screwed it up. And the guy said, "Just flatten, don't do anything, and it'll gradually, you'll be okay. But you have to stop all activity for, you know, a couple of weeks."
So. But this guy said to me,
mm-hmm.
"No, age has gotten you to this point."
Mm.
So, you know, he's, it's massive the way these things happen. Like, for instance, I went into a chiropractor once, and he's giving me a massage. At the time, I was young. And he touches my back, my lower back, where, you know, the coccyx is. And he just says, you know, you broke your coccyx 20 years ago. And I flashed on the moment. And I remember I was going out for a fly ball, playing baseball. And I landed on my coccyx. And it really smarted, you know. But I got up, walked around, and that was it. I broke it.
I know I'm friendly with Tony Gilroy, who wrote that magnificent that you
did. He's great. Tony Gilroy's great.
Yeah. I love Michael Clayton. I love what he wrote for you in Devil's Advocate, that magnificent soliloquy you gave at the very end, which is, I could listen to that over and over again. That was one of the most beautiful pieces of writing.
That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, he's something.
So you talked a long time ago back at I remember the press conference for Devil's Advocate, and I kind of wimped out, but I was going to ask you something that I thought was sort of inappropriate, so I can ask you now. Have you ever decided on your own that this person or that person does the best Al Pacino, Tony Montana imitation? Who do you think does the very, very best? Because everybody does it. You've heard dozens.
The best I ever heard, be really straight about it, would be Johnny Depp. I thought Johnny Depp had, when he did whatever it is that I am, whatever that means, it did sound like, approximate what I think I might sound like.
Mm-hmm.
Because he also did I think he might have caught something else inside too, you know. He caught something. Other than that, it always feels a little, I just never thought it quite, you know, did it. I wouldn't say it, of course, because I did think Johnny caught it the best.
Where can I find it? Did he do it in a YouTube thing? Where did you happen to see it or hear it?
I don't know where he's done it. I do know I've seen him do it, and of course, he never did it in front of me. I made a movie with him, and he never did it in front of me.
Yeah.
Mercifully. But then when I did see him do it somewhere, I guess it was television, he did me. And I thought, okay, yeah. I saw myself once on TV. I did sound a little like that.
In, I think it was 82, when I first came out to Los Angeles, I snuck onto the Universal set. I actually climbed over something. It was a wall or a fence. And I slipped into the Scarface soundstage.
It was the
big home, you know, with the staircase where the family is. And I remember this magnificent, huge, beautiful oil painting of yourself and Michelle Pfeiffer. It was quite large. I mean, we're talking maybe 50.
Well, that's when I was painting in oils.
And I thought, man, this is a beautiful painting. Somebody did a really, really nice job. And then the movie comes along, and you look and you see it for maybe 3/4 of a second, and it's gone.
Wow.
You know.
It is somewhere, though, I'm sure.
Somebody must have it, but I thought it was one of the greatest. Can you tell me really quickly before I leave about Danny Collins, which you're in post on? Do you know? I don't know anything about that.
I think it's coming out, Danny Collins, in March.
Okay.
End of March.
And you own it. It's your movie. You're the lead, right?
I'm the lead with Bobby Cannavale and Ed Benning, Chris Plummer.
Yeah.
It's a nice movie.
Okay. So it's going to be sometime in, March 15. Okay. Well,
that's the odds of March. Say March 20th.
All right, man. Well, very nice talking to you. I hope to see you.
Nice talking to you.
All right, take care.
Thanks.